Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this special live edition of Taking Stock After the Bell on Halloween. We hope you weren't too spooked by the contents of yesterday's budget, but fair to say we're here to pick through any tricks and treats that Rachel Rees delivered for us yesterday. Firstly, I'm joined as always by my co-host and fellow Quilt Achieve It investment manager, James Hughes. Hughesy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, John.
And we're also delighted to be joined by Adam Smith. Adam is the former Chief of Staff to the Chancellor of Exchequer between October 2022 and July 2024. In this role, he was the Chancellor's Senior Advisor on Economics, Politics, Communications and Strategy and responsible for delivering his agenda across Whitehall. He is an expert in financial services policy and regulation, having overseen the design and implementation of the Mansion House reforms and the government's interaction with the Bank of England, Prudential Regulatory Authority and Financial Conduct Authority. Adam led the successful delivery of two budgets and two autumn statements, including the autumn statement of 2022, which restored financial stability to the UK economy. He has a detailed understanding of how these fiscal events are put together and their potential impact on business and financial markets. Prior to entering the Treasury, Adam worked at fast-growing businesses such as Sky Betting and Gaming and Paddy Power. He was also the founding CEO of a healthcare research charity, and his first period in government was as a special advisor at the Department for Culture, Media and Sport in the run-up to the London 2012 Olympic Games. He is a former trustee of the London Parks and Garden Trust and writes a regular blog on the Substack app called The Invisible Hand, presumably in reference to his namesake and hero of mine, the great economist Adam Smith. Adam, good afternoon to you and thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon, John. Thanks for having me. And yes, you're absolutely right about Adam Smith.
Good. Before we begin, everyone, I'd just like to run through some housekeeping. All the engagement tools are resizable and movable. You can move them around to get the most out of your screen and monitor space. If you have any questions during the session, please submit them through the Q&A box. And we've already got a few coming in, so that's good. And a recording will be available after the webinar concludes and can be accessed using the same link sent to you at the point of registration. Without further ado, Adam, what are your high-level thoughts and takeaways from yesterday's pretty extraordinary budget?
Well, first of all, I think extraordinary is right. We maybe too obvious to say this, but it was a very significant event. I think it was the biggest fiscal loosening in 30 years, the biggest set of tax rises in modern history, worth £40 billion, and extra borrowing to the tune of £30 billion a year, all of which to fund a quite significant increase in public spending. So it was a major fiscal event, a big fiscal event. I always think it's useful to think back sort of from politically what the Chancellor would have been trying to achieve before we get into sort of whether she was successful. And I think she had three main aims. Firstly, to try and blame the previous government, me and my former boss, for the need for these tax rises. Secondly, she was very clear that she didn't want to see a return to austerity. And finally, she was going to invest to grow the economy. So if those were her aims, I think my sort of top level reflections on whether she was successful or not are mixed. The Office for Budget Responsibility didn't really help her out on sort of verifying or not this £22 billion black hole. And I'm happy to get into whether I think that exists, was inherited or entirely made up. But I think the jury's basically still out on that one. So that's a bit of a score draw. She has ensured there's no immediate return to austerity with the spending increases that she's allocated for next year and the year after. But after that, spending is very tight again. So I think it's probably fair to say that austerity has been postponed rather than avoided. And then on the growth front, the OBR has reprofiled their growth forecasts compared to March to show a short-term boost, as you would expect from such a big increase in public spending. But then actually growth is lower than it was forecast to be in March throughout the rest of the next 5 years. So I'm not sure she could necessarily yet claim credit on the growth front. So a tough budget, looks in the balance over the short term whether she's sort of successful with her aims. And I think she will be hoping over the medium term that the OBR is wrong on growth. Otherwise, I think, unfortunately, next year or the year after, we might be looking at more tax rises.
No, I think that's fair. And we'll get into some of the detail, particularly around growth, size of the budget, size of the debt levels and borrowing, etc., as we go through. Hughesy, do you just want to sort of touch on how financial markets have reacted leading up to and in the wake of the budget yesterday?
Yeah, sure. So I think initially when the budget, you know, we sort of saw the headlines coming through, I think there was sort of a sense of relief in a way from the market. So sort of some of the areas that we've been concerned on, for example, capital gains tax, BPR on AIM shares. I think, you know, CGT being changed at the top rate to 24%, I think that was better than most of us expected. I think, you know, and on the back of that, you saw sort of a reasonable rally from the FTSE. I think in terms of sort of borrowing levels and forecast growth, again, that was sort of taken as, you know, the market being comfortable with that. You know, there's an indication that inflation might be slightly higher. And as a result of that, gilt yields, sort of certainly short-dated gilt yields, increased quite a bit yesterday by about 20 odd basis points. Interestingly, today the 10-year on gilts has moved up to about 4.5%, and that will be something that the Treasury is watching closely, because with sort of debt increasing, you know, that issuance will need to come to fund the debt or fund the spending. So, you know, as yields are increasing, that's going to cost the government more when they come to issue. Sort of on a sector by sector basis, you know, there wasn't really too much, with probably the exception of house building. So the house builders had a reasonable rally yesterday, and that was sort of on the, I think it was the second pillar of their seven pillars, was around infrastructure spend and again, you know, a bit more on planning reform, and that should be quite beneficial for the house builders. Today, the market, the FTSE has sold off, but I think that's not, you know, there will be some digestion, you know, overnight as people read a bit more detail into the actual report. But I think also bear in mind that the S&P 500 is sort of selling off as well. So it's a bit more global led. I think that sell-off, I don't think it's particularly specific to the budget in terms of what the FTSE is doing. And that's, I guess, the lastly, you know, sterling strengthened very slightly, but it wasn't a meaningful move. So it certainly wasn't the sort of moves we saw after that mini budget with Liz Truss. It was far more calm and collected. So that was pleasing to see.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say we've come into this budget not dissimilarly, actually, to the ill-fated Kwarteng budget, with bond yields globally were rising, predominantly because some of the data in the US has been pretty strong, and there's a strong possibility that Trump gets elected, which is deemed to be inflationary. So again, UK gilt yields have been rising coming into this alongside US Treasury yields. And that, you know, creates a little bit of, I think the analogy that we used about, you know, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng was that they walked into a shed full of fireworks and lit the match. So, you know, we are potentially for the markets in a little bit of a kind of difficult situation with bond yields. And was, you know, as you said, Hughesy, we've seen bond yields move up quite sharply in the last few days, particularly today, actually, and we're having a pretty bad day. So it's very difficult to kind of disentangle the extra borrowing, how the gilt market has taken it specifically versus global bonds. I think the one place to look is at the currency. You know, the difference is last time around sterling fell and bond yields rose, whereas this time around sterling's actually been pretty solid. And that sort of says that it's not necessarily just a UK kind of, look at what's happening here. There's too many gilts to sell and investors won't buy them. So, yeah, a bit of a relief rally in some UK assets, as you said yesterday, some of that being reversed today, but generally nothing kind of major.
It's probably worth actually mentioning on sort of business property relief and the AIM market, you know, the relief that one had before in terms of the 40%, that has been halved to 20%. And I think that was probably a better result than a lot were potentially, worrying about. So the AIM market was very strong yesterday. It was up 5-6%. A little bit of that has been reversed today, but I think that's more so to do with global markets. And FTSE 250 had a reasonable day of performance yesterday as well. So they were sort of the main areas for movement. I think, what we did see coming into it, and when we were speaking to sort of investment funds or investment managers that are running small cap funds, they were keeping their powder dry ahead of that announcement. There were certainly smaller companies they were looking to buy, but hadn't pulled the trigger because they were worried about the impact of BPR being removed in full. And obviously, with that not happening, I suspect there will be some buying going on today and sort of over the coming weeks and those better quality names that they're looking to pick up at discounted valuations.
I think that's fair. Adam, will they be looking at their Bloomberg terminals in the Treasury, watching what every tick in the gilt yield today?
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that I most miss actually was the daily end of day summary that the team used to send
Oh, really?
ministers and special advisors. Yeah, which covered, just movement in the FTSE at all levels, gilt yields, sterling. And it very helpfully would calculate what they thought that had done to debt interest payments, and therefore sort of how much things had changed from the last economic forecast. And I think that is an important thing to note. I mean, in many ways, it sort of doesn't really matter what has caused gilt yields to spike. I think with debt interest payments now, I think the OBR said they were £100 billion a year. Any continued increase in yields will push that cost up even further, which again, is less money for public spending and probably means more tax rises are needed. So yeah, we used to watch very carefully, particularly obviously after a fiscal event, but actually just routinely. Every day we'd always get an update, and at the end of the week it would sort of recalculate where they thought that put us. So they will be watching it like a hawk, I would have thought.
Well, they're probably not having much fun this afternoon. Move on to some slides. I mean, she's talked about relentlessly, both her and the Prime Minister talked relentlessly about going for growth in this Parliament as a way to kind of, fund our public services. Is this chart here pretty damning in terms of the budget from the OBR? I mean, essentially what it's telling us is that growth in the next year or so will be a bit stronger than anticipated back in March, but towards the end of the forecast period, 27, 28, 29, growth is predicted to be lower than it was back in March, in part because of the impact of tax rises. Will this worry the Chancellor, do you think, Adam?
Well, I think it will do. And actually, there was an even starker chart that the OBR put out, which had what they call the pre-measures forecast. So this was what they thought would happen to GDP each year before they took into account any of the government policies. And then they had what the government policies then did. And it showed very clearly that the increase in employer national insurance had reduced growth in each year after 2026. And so that is pretty stark. That is a government choice, a government policy that is reducing growth. And I find it quite strange to think that, they would have known about this for a couple of weeks, certainly. They would have obviously known the tax policy they were going to do, and they would have got back from the OBR forecast that showed the impact. And yet they keep talking about how growth is their number one mission, and I think it should be their number one mission. I think you could probably have done some different policies to ensure that this chart didn't look quite so bad.
And
she,
no, I think that's fair.
yesterday during the budget, Adam, a couple of times she mentioned that the forecast on the OBR for March were not correct, and they'd said that if they'd had, if the full facts had been given to them, then actually the growth forecast would have been quite different. That was obviously, quite pointed in her comments. What was that alluding to, or does that make any sense from where you were sitting, that the numbers that the OBR were given in March weren't as accurate as they should have been?
So this goes to the heart of the 22 billion black hole in public finances that is central to the government's, political narrative. And what the OBR had said in their separate report, which they published yesterday, was that there was actually, I think, £8 to £9 billion of spending pressures, which occurred that they didn't know about when they did their March forecast. And as a result, they might have taken £3 billion of spending away. And all I would say to that is sort of £9 to £10 billion of spending pressures in a £1 trillion budget midway through the year is sort of normal. I mean, the first year that I was in the Treasury, I remember we had a new Chief Secretary to the Treasury come in, and she was presented with £9 billion of spending pressures. And 4 months later, they had all disappeared. You know, like any finance director, you move money around, there's underspends in some projects, you sometimes choose not to do things that you were forecast to do. So the OBR said that they might have changed things by £3 billion or so. And I think £3 billion or so on public spending wouldn't have impacted growth forecasts. So I think that's part of the sort of political, you know, attempts to blame the previous government. And I would say that, wouldn't I, given I was part of it. But I think most, the chairman of the OBR, who I have criticised for all sorts of things, so I'm going to rally to his defence now, very helpfully said that nothing he had said legitimised what the Chancellor has claimed.
Okay, that's really helpful.
A few more charts in terms of forecasts and the sort of trajectory of the public finances. The October forecast here in blue showing borrowing to be significantly higher. I haven't got every year in here, but just the first year and the final year of the forecast period. As we talked about, a lot of debt issuance to come to fund that. Public sector net borrowing, we can see the sort of the lighter blue line as the forecast is looking higher than it was in March in yellow. And I think probably, you know, public sector net debt, and I don't think we need to necessarily get into the specifics of the changes to the fiscal rules, but it's fair to say that public sector debt on whichever measure is pretty elevated relative to history, and therefore, you know, how much wiggle room do chancellors have? I think the kind of more philosophical thing that I want to just sort of touch on, Adam, a little bit with you is the size of the state. The chart here goes back to 1948, and it shows that public spending as a share of GDP is pretty much higher than at any point since the Second World War, absent the 2020 COVID period when we switched the furlough scheme on, projected to be kind of 44% of GDP, nearing half of our output, and taxes as a share of GDP, again, higher than at any point since the Second World War, and expected to be higher than under previous plans under the Conservative government in which you served. Is this kind of classic Labour tax and spend budget, or are we in a kind of period, I guess, where governments are structurally bigger? Is this what people expect? People want public services? I'm sort of just interested in your sort of take on that, really.
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right that it's a classic tax and spend budget, and the profiles that you see there in the yellow that we had spending and tax coming down as a share of GDP. But to be fair, those plans were pretty decisively rejected by the public in the general election. So I don't think anybody is necessarily surprised that Labour put up taxes to put up spending. And I think most people would agree that public services probably need more funding. I think the surprise has sort of come from perhaps the scale and oddly the sort of profiling of that spending, where it goes up quite considerably in the next 2 years, but then drops away again and becomes increasingly tighter. And I think the one thing sort of, I guess, philosophically that's missing from what Labour talked about yesterday is anything on welfare reform. I mean, the size of the welfare budget is due to skyrocket over the next 5 years and then keep skyrocketing. And I think that was certainly the area that the Conservatives had planned to target, we set out plans to target, were we to have been back in office. And I think it would be better for the economy and society as a whole if we sort of focused on getting a grip of that budget and perhaps redirecting some of that into public services rather than putting these sort of growth dampening tax rises in.
I think we open up lots of questions in terms of, you know, what we want the state to do and achieve, and the politics in particular of the pension budget and state pensions is pretty, I don't know what to say, contentious. So it would take a very brave politician to stand up and say that the triple lock on state pension is not sustainable in the medium to long term. But that's probably a webinar all in itself. And this won't cheer many of our viewers up in terms of, this was the Treasury's own analysis from their own budget document, in terms of where the tax rises and spending cuts fall in terms of distributional impact, with the black line being the overall impact. And you can see quite clearly that the top decile of households by income facing the greatest burden in terms of picking up the cost of the budget, measures such as tax on private schools, a few other things that we'll touch on, really are the kind of one thing. But again, you know, this is a kind of classic Labour budget in that sense, with the those lowest income households being the biggest beneficiaries, right?
Yes, and I think, you know, short term, the Chancellor would have been very pleased with this graph. Mm. And actually, these distributional impact charts take up quite a lot of discussion in the run-up to any budget, because there are obviously different ways you can cut the numbers to show what you want. I think interestingly, though, you've got external organisations. So the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, I think overnight, but certainly this morning, have said that those on lower incomes are set to be £700 in real terms worse off over the course of this Parliament, thanks to the decisions in the budget, and that's mainly because of the threshold changes in national insurance. Yep. Affects mm-hmm. the lower paid much more than it does the sort of middle paid. So I think although this looks pretty good, I don't think that tells quite the full picture. And also then there's what's the economic impact of hitting that top decile? Well, we sort of have seen that in the growth forecasts.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Moving on then, what actually was announced? We don't necessarily need to go through all these line by line, but capital gains tax has been increased. So the basic rate from 10 to 18%, higher rate from 20 to 24 for investments. This aligns it to residents' capital gains rate. Obviously, that employer national insurance increased by 1.2%, and the threshold reduced to £5,000. And I think the threshold reduction is probably the bigger part of the tax rise overall. And we've got a number of questions coming in about pensions, but essentially pensions to be brought into scope for inheritance tax from April 2027. We did sort of think that the attractive death benefits on pension funds would be under the microscope. We didn't necessarily think that they would just bring them into the estate for IHT. There is a consultation happening, so I think we'll talk about this a little bit later. We've got a number of questions about it. But anything we do say is very much caveated by, this isn't set in stone yet. There is a consultation. There's likely to be some tweaks and changes, and any changes not scheduled for another kind of 2.5 years. Inheritance tax, AIM stocks now have a 20% inheritance tax charge on them, as opposed to being eligible for business property relief. Business property relief and agricultural property relief have seen increases, essentially, where individuals will get 100% relief on IHT up to £1 million and will pay a 50% rate of IHT, i.e. 20%, on values over £1 million. The non-DOM regime is to be abolished from April 2025, which actually, I think, Adam, is a policy that the previous government had. That's going to be quite interesting for a relatively small cohort of very wealthy people, set to raise about £9 billion, I think, which sounded quite optimistic, because I don't think there are many left, because they've probably mostly all gone abroad. And then finally, VAT to be levied on school fees from January 2025. And also the other interesting thing about the school fees is that private schools were going to be levied business rates from April 2025, which again is a kind of double hit for them. It'll be good to touch on things that haven't been changed and that had been feared about. ISA allowances are to be kept intact, if I'm right, through to 2030. So no changes there. And we were a little bit worried about, you know, ISA allowances being reduced. The pension annual allowance, i.e. how much money you can put into your pension each year if you're earning, and that's been retained. The tax-free cash entitlement of 25% up to the 268,000 level has been retained, and no changes to the lifetime allowance regime, where effectively there is no lifetime allowance charge. Hughesy, have I kind of missed anything on that front?
No, I don't. We were concerned about NI contributions, weren't we, on pension top-ups potentially, but that that wasn't announced, which was a good thing. I think that was it. But certainly, I think the ISA part was one area that our clients and we were really worrying about. So that was, in my view, one of the positives that ISA allowance has been retained until 2030. And I think, you know, that's quite positive. But as you say, I think you've covered everything.
Okay. If we kind of dig in a little bit to, I think, one of the most impacted areas for clients, and we've had numerous questions in on the matter already, is the pension fund aspect. I think it's fair to say for the last few years, since the pension freedoms in 2015, pensions have been used as a vehicle for efficiently passing wealth on to the next generation, as it essentially sidesteps the IHT regime. Plenty of questions here. Essentially, what we think is going to happen as it's laid out is that your pension will form part of your estate and be tested for IHT. Your pension fund will pay directly any inheritance tax that is due on a sort of pro-rated share. So if your estate is $1 million and your pension is $1 million, if we ignore any allowances for the sake of the explanation, then you know, your pension fund would pay half the IHT overall due. And then the most kind of really surprising aspect of it is that, having paid inheritance tax on the pension, your beneficiaries will still have to pay income tax on any money they take out. So what this essentially means is that if we had £1 million in a pension fund and all of it is subject to IHT, £400,000 gets paid to the revenue for the IHT. You have £600,000 left for your beneficiary. If your beneficiary wanted to draw any money out, they would need to pay income tax at their marginal rate of 20% or 40% or even 45% if there were additional rate taxpayers. In that somewhat extreme example, your beneficiary would essentially be taxed 67% of the fund value on your passing if they were to draw it all out. Is this kind of classic kind of Labour politics, socialist politics, Adam, or is there kind of, you know, good reason why you think they've done this?
So I actually don't necessarily think it's good. It's sort of classic Labour policy, although it is kind of aligned. It's more classic Treasury official policy. So this option was presented to Jeremy Hunt when he was Chancellor a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Because the Treasury were worried that pensions were being used to avoid inheritance tax. And, you know, he sort of looked at it for all sorts of reasons. That sort of double taxation point that we've, you know, just touched upon, primarily one of them, but also just the general feeling that if you sort of saved into a pension on the understanding that you can pass it on, to then suddenly come in and take 40% of it just felt inherently unfair. Mm-hmm. So I think and actually the same is true for a few of these. So long-standing sort of Treasury policy official views is that capital gains tax should be more closely aligned to income tax. They aren't a big fan of any of the reliefs in IHT for AIM or agricultural business property relief. And actually one that we don't have on here, I don't think, was business assets disposal relief, which they've increased. But obviously they renamed that bad relief for a reason. They didn't like all of these sorts of reliefs. And so I think the more interesting point here is that, you know, these policies have been around as options for a number of years. And I just going back to your sort of your point earlier, sort of philosophically, they just didn't appeal to any of more recent previous chancellors. And I guess we now have a chancellor that was more inclined to agree and maybe came from a similar sort of outlook. But so I'm not necessarily certain that they're sort of, you know, classic Labour things, but it's more what the Treasury would describe as good tax policy. Every time one of the officials said that to me, I immediately asked, who's the loser? Because good tax policy normally means somebody's paying more somewhere, as opposed to what I would think is good tax policy, which is somebody paying less.
Yeah, no, that's fair. We've plenty of questions about this in the chat. So firstly, we've got a few questions about spousal exemption. So my understanding is, and again, this is all subject to consultation and tweaks, etc., spousal exemptions will apply to inherited pensions. And whether the rules are the same for post and pre 75 is something that I don't know the answer to at this stage, I'm afraid, but it's something that we can find out in due course once it all becomes slightly clearer.
I think the important thing, John, is this consultation period, some of, you know, the actual rules haven't been exactly defined yet. And I think the other thing sort of highlight is, you know, we have a party in government at the moment that has changed these rules. You know, it will probably, with the advice from professionals, you know, people might draw from pensions in different ways, but the term is only 5 years. You know, these tax changes can change again. There's nothing to say that, you know, if a new party comes into power, then some of this might be removed. So it is important. You know, our view would be, when talking to clients, it's really important to, first of all, look at the consultation properly and wait for that probably, but also, you know, these things, you know, the landscape can change essentially.
Yeah, and there is no need for anyone to make any decisions today based on what we do or don't know just yet. Everyone's circumstances is different, and therefore people should take specialist advice as and when they feel they need to over the next couple of years. I think the other couple of things that might be worth pointing out, you know, if people want to feel like they are doing something, moving all of one's pensions into one pot for ease of admin is probably going to be a very good thing for your executors. The logistics of having three or four different pension schemes and having to get probate valuations and pro rata tax amongst three or four different administrators. I mean, most pension administrators won't feel it unkind for me to say that they're not almost always the most administratively efficient organisations. So if there is something that people do feel they need to do kind of now today, probably consolidate your pensions into one scheme to make it easy to plan and kind of from the admin side of things. But in terms of some of the details, it's probably too early to start making, you know, valid kind of conclusions and action points, albeit if the rules come in as they look today, then it's probably going to be preferable for people to start accessing their pensions, taking out the income and either spending it or giving it away. But that's, you know, a very early take that is definitely not one that people should be acting on just yet. I'm going to mop up a couple of other questions in the Q&A box. The change to CGT, yeah, the CGT changes on shares and general investments that took hold from Tuesday night. So any sales made yesterday or today will have the new 18 and 24% rates applied as opposed to the old rates. And the relief on AIM stocks has been any present investments in AIM portfolios will now be subject to 20%. And that's on all values. That's not just values over £1 million. So there's a slight difference there now between AIM investments and ordinary business property relief, where if you've got business property relief, then you've got the first £1 million with full relief. That's not the case with AIM.
There was a question on business asset disposals as well and the different rates that are changing. I've got my understanding is it's 10% this year, and then I think 14% in April 25 and 18% 26 to 27 for that question that came in.
Yep. Very good. Adam, if we kind of come back to this idea of growth and put this chart back up and what the government, I mean, clearly from what the OBR have said and from, you know, if you whack a load of taxes on businesses for employing people, then don't be surprised if that does damage growth over a 3 to 5 year period. I mean, what could the Chancellor have done, or what can the Chancellor do from here going forward? One of the questions we had on pre-registration, you know, what can the government do to kickstart growth? Would rejoining the EU help, for instance? Necessarily need to get into a kind of conversation about rejoining the EU, but, you know, what could the Chancellor have done in terms of policies and changes made today to really kind of get growth going, do you think?
Well, I think firstly, let's look at what she did do on the positive side of the ledger. So she has used some of that borrowing to increase capital investment, and she's sort of increased that quite significantly. And the OBR give her some benefit in terms of GDP impact for that. Not a huge amount over 5 years, I think 0.14%. But that does go up over 10 years, and in 50 years, it will have added 1.4% to GDP. So increased capital spending, therefore, does help with growth. I think probably, actually, quite a few people who were calling for her to do that, maybe wishing she'd got a bit further and increased more, but we would have possibly seen an even bigger reaction to the gilt markets if that had been the case. And then I think the other thing that she will be hoping for but hasn't happened as yet is that she gets a growth benefit from the planning reforms that she's announced and that they previously announced. And I'm sure there will be some growth benefits to those. Interestingly, the OBR has historically never really changed its growth forecast, or depending on what the government of the day has done on planning, arguing that actually it tends to sort of reduce to zero over the sort of medium term. But I think I would imagine if they do genuinely speed up the big infrastructure project, that will have a lasting impact on growth. May not see it in the forecast for a few years, but she will be hoping that that comes around. And then the other things to look at in terms of what does the OBR score favourably on growth. If I look back at the time I was there, one of the most positive impacts on GDP that they recognised was the extension of free childcare. They thought that would put, I think it was 100,000 full-time equivalents back into the labour market, and it really did. They upped their growth forecasts when we did that. And then they also gave us a growth benefit from the cuts to national insurance we did, which obviously wasn't on the cards this time around. So I think my general reflection is that actually the OBR does try to give benefit to the sort of supply side and the supply side impact of certain government policies. There's always going to be arguments over whether they should give more for some things or they don't quite get it right. But a criticism they often get attacked with is that they don't recognise the benefits of certain policies. I don't think that's fair. And they have been doing quite a lot more on that. It's just in this budget, the benefits that are coming from increased capital spending are far outweighed by the negatives on the employer national insurance increase, which I think over 5 years, we would all probably just instinctively feel that's probably true. I was going to sort of skirt over the EU issue. I mean, I think personally, I think it would be more upheaval than it's worth. I sort of think that ship has sailed in many ways, and we're better looking at other things. But that is obviously a very personal view, and others will have different opinions in the other direction, I'm sure.
I think so. I think the pro-growth childcare policies would definitely be one that these presenters and co-hosts will be frothing at the mouth for. But no news on it yesterday. But hopefully,
Adam, can I just ask around? You know, there's a huge increase in the tax take, and you know, I think when we discussed this before, sort of pre the budget, we were anticipating, the pro-growth agenda, where the money was going to go and which services were to be developed. I think my instinct yesterday was some disappointment in terms of where this tax, where the tax is going, because it looked to me like it's going towards the NHS, some, schools and the green energy project, and that was about it really. There wasn't much detail for us to get excited about, I felt. Did you have the same take, or were you expecting something different?
Well, yeah, a similar take. I mean, I always thought the NHS would get more money, but I think the interesting thing is that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have spent a long time talking about investing in growth, and so I expected to see a bit more go to productive assets that will increase long-term growth rate. So things like whether that's a road project or energy infrastructure, or broadband, I guess, or those sorts of things. And as worthy as increasing the budget for school buildings and repairing some hospitals are, those are obviously worthy things to do. They are not growth enhancing. I mean, they will be growth enhancing in the short term in terms of people doing that building activity, but they don't add to the long run supply side of the economy. And so I think it was a bit of a missed opportunity, possibly. Maybe in future budgets they will change things, and maybe for the spending review next year, where they then allocate the money for the next 2 years, maybe we will then see a reorientation towards more pro-growth areas of spending. But certainly in the short term, as in next year, schools and NHS, as you say, got the lion's share of the funding.
And what about planning reform and house building? It seems that every government in recent history has had a target to build a lot of houses and has so far failed. Is the fact that Labour don't have many seats in the southeast where house building is arguably most needed, will that help them? The sort of lack of NIMBYism, if you like, from the backbenchers, will that help Angela Rayner get, a ton of houses built in the southeast?
Well, you would hope so, although somewhat ironically, they've got such a large number of new MPs that I think there are quite a few of them that are now, with big green belt areas. But even if they turn into good old classic NIMBYs, you would expect that they would still be able to get through those sorts of planning changes. The interesting thing actually is more, I think, we're talking to people that I know in the house building sector, whether those planning reforms alone are enough to meet the new targets. It seems to be a bit of an open question, but I think on that front, I would certainly hope they are. But and anything more they need to do, I would encourage them to do so.
There's definitely, I mean, if you listen to the listed house builders, they definitely talk about, shortage of skilled labour, shortage of materials, not just the planning. But, my view would be that if you had some more planning and the sort of supply would kind of create itself in a way, the market tends to work. If you start paying brickies 50,000 a year, then, don't be surprised if there are a few more brickies knocking around the place in a few years' time. But so on the sort of subject of kind of big government, a good question here, I think. Is there any evidence from history that a tax and spend strategy has actually worked? Put you on the spot, isn't
Well, I guess, well, I think the new Labour years, well, sort of, causality is always a tricky one, isn't it? But I think, I think you could probably be generous and look back at the sort of 2000s, certainly once Brown had put national insurance up and started spending more on the NHS, that growth was pretty healthy through those years. Whether that's linked, I don't know. And actually, counterintuitively, I think if you looked at the early years of the coalition years, where the size of the state was decreased quite significantly, growth was up compared to what we've seen more recently. And I think that would suggest the classic case of if the public sector pulls back, the private sector sort of floods in to replace it. So I'm not sure whether there's proof or otherwise. I mean, you sort of go back to the 70s, and I would suggest that perhaps not. And maybe we'll see a repeat. It felt like a 1970s Labour budget yesterday, but hopefully it won't have the same effect.
There were some striking similarities as where we are in the world in terms of we just had a massive inflationary episode. We'll see. We've talked a bit about in the pod in the past, and Mihizi, about how the next 10 years might look very different to the last 10, 15, with kind of higher growth, higher inflation, more volatile commodities, more, you know, a very different environment to what we've been used to, which I think could potentially cause some headaches for governments, particularly on the debt side of things. We had plenty of questions in about debt and debt to GDP levels, et cetera. And we've talked a bit about growth and whether, you know, that is kind of the answer for it. I am going to touch on a couple of other questions. There's a question here, is the AIM 20% IHT levy with immediate effect? I think that's from April 6th. Is that right, Yuzi? So, you know, if you've got an AIM portfolio, then if you're really worried about it, you've got until April the 5th, but it's not necessarily advice. And then, plenty, as I said before, plenty of kind of questions on pensions, etc. And just on the AIM thing again, do they still need to be held for 2 years before death to qualify for the 20% rate? My understanding is that yes, they do have to be held for 2 years, then they get the 20% relief, if you like, or the 50% relief on the 40%, if that makes sense. And answer the question on CGT, etc. Bear with me a minute whilst I...
There's a question on CGT on EIS investments. No, there was no change to that at all. And actually, I think there's an interesting question here, which is why did we not hear the words tech, innovation and export within the budget? I think that's, you know, I think that sort of goes back to my question to you, Adam, which is, you know, taxes are increasing. You know, the Labour government in its manifesto was a lot, you know, there's a lot of focus on growth and investment and getting these sectors working, but actually very little in terms of detail within the budget. I mean, was that a surprise from you?
Yes, and I think what they successfully managed to do, which I think we touched on right at the very beginning, was they made the sort of, you know, high growth sectors, tech sector, for instance, feel like it was going to be a terrible budget for them. And then when CGT, for instance, sort of only went up a few percentage points, everyone kind of breathed a bit of a sigh of relief. So that was sort of classic case of Treasury expectation management. But I think you're right. I'm surprised that there wasn't more focus on, I guess, the sectors of the future. And I know they obviously have made quite a big play of having an industrial strategy with their eight key sectors, of which technology is one. But I don't think there was an awful lot in the budget for any of those sectors, really, which is surprising. And I suspect what they're hoping is that things they can do away from tax and spend may help on that front. Now, I'm not sure that will necessarily be the case, but maybe they are hoping for some sort of regulatory changes or something like that they could try and help those sectors with, and have possibly underestimated the impact of changes to, I think, capital gains tax in particular, has on that kind of entrepreneurial part of the economy. So I was a bit surprised about that. Maybe there'll be more, in months to come.
What about tech and innovation within the public sector? One of the areas of contention has been that public sector productivity has been really poor. I think you might know the detail, Adam, but I think there was some sort of select committee hearing with a boss of one of the railway companies talking about how they still use fax machines for disseminating information to their employees, which made me chuckle. Even in when I started my career, fax machines were on the way out. Like, what can the government do to kind of get the public services delivered more effectively, more cost effectively and more productively?
Well, I could only go by what we tried to do when I was at the Treasury, and in the March budget, Jeremy Hunt announced 3.4 billion, I think it was, money for NHS technology projects. The important thing on that was that whilst we were working out how much we were going to spend and on what, we got the NHS to sign up to the fact that they would only get this money if they would agree to a 2% increase in productivity every year. Now, I think 2% increase sounds frighteningly small, but for the NHS, this was a big thing. And over the course of 5 years, it would have released, I think it was £30 billion of savings. So my point there really is that what government can, the big lever that government has is money. So if you want reform and you want productivity enhancements, you have to use funding as your negotiating chip. And I think what's slightly concerning this time around is that whilst the Health Secretary, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister are talking about reforming the NHS in particular and more broadly reforming public services, they've already signed up to massive increases in spending and haven't yet got anything in return. And I think once you've sort of set out that you're going to give public services a lot more money, to then try and get them to sort of, you know, agree to productivity targets is the wrong way around. The productivity targets that the Chancellor did announce was actually a 2% productivity target for Whitehall departments. Mm. So that's a, you know, fine thing to do, but not really where the bulk of the spending goes, obviously. But I would have thought if Whitehall departments can find 2% a year, where you'll get real savings is asking the NHS, bearing in mind they committed to it when we gave them 3.4 billion, now that they've had 22 billion and haven't had to sign up to that, that just seems a strange way round to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've probably all got stories and anecdotes about spending some time within the health service and seeing some of the somewhat chaotic method that which they use to kind of organise themselves between files, notes, computer systems, computers that don't work, people using their phones, etc. So I'm sure there is plenty of scope within public service as a whole to kind of find some savings and some efficiency gains, but it doesn't seem to have been a particularly strong focus yesterday. Got an interesting point here from David. Speaking to a couple of small business owners, the extra national insurance combined with the minimum wage increase will cripple them, and they are cancelling plans to employ more staff. Is this likely to be, you know, something that's quite widespread, do you think? I mean, you know, ultimately the source of the reduction in growth forecast over the next 4 or 5 years or so is because of the increase in NI. Is there a real risk that private enterprise gets crimped by these tax rises?
I think so, but, you know, don't take my word necessarily for it. I think look at what the OBR said, particularly about the labour market. And I think they said it was going to mean 50,000 full-time equivalent fewer workers in the labour market. So I assume that is, you know, that is exactly that kind of example that David, I think it was, has given businesses deciding now not to hire extra people, scale that up over the whole economy. And they think that would total about 50,000. So I think there is a very real danger of that. And, you know, I'm not sure now what can be done to alleviate that, given that the tax rises have been announced and the living wage has been announced.
And then in terms of small businesses, we've also got another question from Ash, a colleague. SMEs and family-owned businesses and farmers, I'm going to add to that list, will face challenges for business continuity with BPR, APR reduced to 50%. What is the thinking there? What will the Chancellor have been trying to achieve with those changes to BPR and APR, do you think?
So the arguments that were made when I was there about why actually they should have been, those reliefs should have been abolished in their entirety was the view then, was that it was a very small number of extremely rich landowners or a small number of large family businesses disproportionately benefit from those reliefs. Now, we didn't agree with that because we didn't do the policy change, but that's the justification. And I think possibly where they've ended up is a view that, well, we can't get rid of them all entirely, because there are, obviously it would have been a bit like the winter fuel payment decision, where the reason why they restricted that was because some very rich pensioners were getting it. You can't abolish a relief just because some rich, you know, landowners are benefiting from it. So they've tried to, I think, in their, they use the word better, target it. I think the problem with that is that you end up, you know, pleasing nobody. You don't raise all of the money that you perhaps would have done, and you underestimate the kind of the impact on the sectors and the behavioural impact it will have on future family businesses and family farms.
Is it foreseeable this could be the kind of pasty tax moment one they row back on?
So the agricultural property relief seems to be getting a bit of ahead of steam in particular. I can't quite remember off the top of my head when they were planning to bring that in. Was that next year or the year after?
Year after, I think, April 26.
Yeah, so definitely time, I would say. If it was coming in April, I would say no, it's almost certainly just going to happen. If it's coming in the April afterwards, then yeah, you never know. That could be the sort of thing that quite a vocal political campaign, particularly if you harness all the, you know, the family businesses across the country, the family farms who will suddenly face an increased tax bill. You could see that a letter writing campaign to local MPs, etc., building up a bit of a head of steam on that one. There's time, certainly.
For sure. Kizzy, one last question for you, I think. Do you think the FTSE 100 will hit 9,000 at any point in 2025? It's not actually that far away, is it, really?
No, you saved the good one for me, then.
Look,
it depends what the constituents inside are doing. You know, you've got to remember the FTSE is made up of some very large oil and gas businesses, some large mining businesses, some banks and industrials, etc. So, you know, it depends what the underlying earnings are from those companies. I think, the oil and gas sector has gone through a tricky period recently with OPEC making some changes. So certainly those share prices have been under pressure, although, you know, decent results out from Shell this morning. But, you know, as we always say to clients, it's impossible to predict. But, you know, what we do as investment managers is invest in the best quality businesses we can within the sectors of the FTSE. So, you know, a lot of those good businesses pay, you know, great dividend streams to our clients and are able to compound growth well from reinvesting in themselves. So I don't have an answer, I'm afraid, but, you know, ultimately we're going through earnings season at the moment, and on the whole, you know, the businesses are doing what we want them to be doing. So, that's a long-winded answer.
Yeah, it's only 14 months away and it's only kind of 12%. So, you know, it's not insurmountable to get to 9,000. Next year, it'd be quite nice. The FTSE feels like it hasn't moved at all in my entire 20-year career doing this. But
when you add on the dividends and total return, it's much better.
It's been all right. I think there's. I think we'll wrap it up there. We've had quite a lot of kind of questions on specifics and technical stuff that we're neither qualified nor knowledgeable enough nor confident enough to answer, in the affirmative. If you visit the events section of the Quilt Achievement website, there are a couple of further webinars coming up, one in particular with David Denton, our technical specialist. I can confirm he is currently, you know, knee deep in all the Treasury documents, and he is wading through it with the size of the brain that he has. So he'll be able to answer a few more specifics in terms of pensions in particular, and also other areas. But thanks all for joining us today. I hope you found it useful. Do feel free to share with friends, family, and on social media if you think that would be of interest to others. If you've got any further questions or would like any more information, I think there's a link for you to get in touch with us somewhere on this screen somewhere, so please do that. Adam, thank you very much to you for your time today, and keep up the good work with the blog, The Invisible Hand.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much, Adam.
Thank you to you, Heezy, and thanks very much, and we'll hope to see you soon. Thanks, Sam.